Now hear this, my friend.
Welcome. Welcome, all of you, to St. Anne's this evening. I've never done anything like this before. But it's good to be here. Thank you for coming. This is the first of our series during Lent. Each Tuesday night here at 7:30, and a different guest. And I'm very pleased that this evening we have... Hello. Hello. It's a great privilege to welcome Paul Clark tonight. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Of course, there are some people here who will know that Paul is no stranger to St. Anne's. In fact, Paul, you're coming home.
I'm coming home.
He's coming home.
And yeah. before I answer the question, yes. Just can I say thank you to the people who've been asking about my mum tonight. You've missed her at church. She had a fall at home. She didn't break anything. They were very loath to let her out of hospital too soon. She was at respite home. She is with my sister tonight, and she's due to go back home to Lisburn tomorrow.
Great.
So I will happily say that you were all asking for her. So
absolutely. So please let... I don't know that we're holding her in prayer.
Indeed.
So and we do miss her. We miss her. We certainly do.
Well, to answer the question, right.
Yes, so you're coming home because... You were an altar boy here.
Not only that, before I was an altar boy, I was at St. Anne's Primary School. You know, and indeed, for those of you of a certain age, my recollection is of Mr. McCreeve, who was the principal in those days. And then one of the teachers at that stage was Jack McClure, who latterly went on to be the principal of the primary school up at St. Coleman's. So I spent seven lovely years, I have to say, truly, at St. Anne's, and then I was an altar boy.
Altar boy, and who do you remember the priests at that
time? Well, now, here's the thing. I mean, do we all go back that far? Yes, we all, right, okay. Now, whenever I say Father Jim Kelly, I don't mean the most recent Jim. Mm-hmm. I do mean an older Father Kelly who was here, who wore boots all the time, and he was the parish priest. And then Father Brendan McGee was the curate in the parish. And then after that, Jim Kelly was the parish priest here. Uh-huh. And Malachy Murphy was a curate. Uh-huh.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if Donald McKeown was in this parish or not, but he was,
because my brother was
an altar boy while he was here. And Donald and I are still very much in touch. And he always asks about my brother, Philip.
Philip. Yeah, good. You went to St. Mary's Grammar School.
Yeah.
Yeah. At that time, you were living, I believe, in Seymour.
Seymour Hill, yeah.
But you had to leave Seymour.
We did.
Unexpectedly.
That was just basically after I had finished at school. The reason why I went to St. Mary's was because my best friend at St. Anne's here was a guy called Brendan Cashel. His father was George Cashel. He taught geography at St. Mary's. So he was going there. That was the reason why.
Okay.
And of course, George Cashel was a member of this parish here. I was at his funeral a number of years ago. But so we moved out into Seymour Hill in the late 1950s. It was one of those estates that was being developed because they were doing a lot of clearance in the city centre. Uh-huh. So they were, you know, taking down the old housing on Donegal Pass and Sandy Row in the area of the village as well. And so a lot of the people were coming out there. So we were coming from Botanic Avenue. We were Catholic. A lot of our friends and neighbours were Protestants in the early 1970s. In truth, to be crude about it, they didn't want a fiend about the place. And so at the end of the day, we had to leave. Now, what they did was they threw a petrol bomb against the wall of the house. In those days, the houses were whitewashed. So the warning was it went against the wall. There was a scorch mark the next day, and you would have known, and they would have known, oh, that's a Catholic home. And the warning was inherent in that, if you don't move now, the next time it'll be through your window. And that was it. And you know something? Our neighbours were brilliant. You know, they did not want us to go. But that was the way it had to be. Yeah. And Mum and Dad would say on reflection that it was the best thing for them because they bought their first house, in that case, up at Caleton. and then latterly moved to Lisburn. So I suppose in that sense there was a silver lining. Yeah. You know, and I remember years later having a conversation with the then MP Jim Molyneux, the former leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, now dead, and he apologised for what had happened to us in the estate. And latterly as well, Geoffrey Donaldson was aware of the history and said so. But I said to both of them separately, I said, you don't need to apologise because, you know, you did not do this. And I bear absolutely no hatred, no ill will whatsoever towards the people at that at that time.
Let me take you to your time in St Mary's Grammar School, because I'm aware that, in fact, that myself, I was in St Malachy's College, by the way, you know, and I'm aware that myself and Paul spent a weekend away together.
In our teenage years.
Whether it was my lower sixth or upper sixth, I'm not too sure. But it was a vocations weekend in Dromalis in Larne. The Treat House.
That's right.
And the first one, I think, was 1971, early, around about this time, February 1971. It was organised by Father Martin Kelly, who's now retired.
He was
the spiritual director and vocations director in St Malachy's. And he organised it, and he invited boys who were in their A-level years to come to Larne. If they were thinking, you know, maybe thinking about priesthood, that might be another option. And I went. And it's only in recent times that I discovered that Paul was there as well from St Mary's.
Yeah.
So it was, you know.
I wasn't the only one.
There was a whole crowd of us. And but one of the things that I remember about that first weekend in 1971, we had a kind of retreat from the Friday to the Saturday evening. And Saturday evening, there was entertainment led on.
The ponchos.
Very good. Yes. But this Saturday evening, there was a bit of entertainment.
Now, hang on. We have to tell you this.
Yes.
Ponchos were beautiful little girls. I mean, when I say little girls.
Los ponchos.
Right, okay.
This was a group of dancing girls from St. Oliver Plunkett Parish. They were brought,
And we were considering the priesthood. Could you imagine that?
I think it was Father Jackie Fitzsimons.
I don't recall that. Right, okay.
It was then. And Oliver Plunkett brought them for our entertainment on a Saturday night. This was a vocations weekend. You know? They wore ponchos, knitted ponchos, and did this dance, singing and dancing routine. But that always stuck out my mind about that. And that was the Saturday night entertainment. Then on the Sunday, Bishop Philbin came and celebrated Mass with us, and we met him. We got an opportunity to meet him on the one-to-one if we did it. And then later on in the afternoon, different priests from different ministries came and shared their experiences as well. You know, so that was... 1971.
So I recall being there on two different occasions. I mean, I suppose my mum, being a very traditional Irish Catholic and originally from the south, always thought that, you know, it'd be nice to have a son who's a priest. And I did consider the vocation. I did, and as an older boy, you know, she was encouraging me as you do. I always remember at St Mary's, because of the Christian Brothers ethos, they were always encouraging us to be consider the brotherhood. As a vocation rather than the priesthood. And I was thinking to myself, but if you're a brother, you can't say Mass. Uh-huh. And I was thought to myself, it's a halfway house, you know, so why not go the whole way?
Okay.
You
were into music in a big way at that time. And you were doing discos.
I was. It was something I really got into in my teenage years. I enjoyed it immensely, and it became my early career as well. But I was encouraged, and I have to say, not least by the youth club in this parish, because there was the resident DJ here was a guy called Jimmy Clark. Now, he's no relation. He's C-L-A-R-K-E, right. And Jimmy latterly was the head of the CCMS, and Jimmy and our paths have crossed, because he worked also for Jim Aiken, and I was very, very fond of Jim. And I mean, on a Sunday night, we'd be having a discos in here, and in the school, basically, in the assembly hall, dining hall, and I would have been up there, and I'd have been doing my thing. I still can't do it, by the way.
Was DJ your first job?
I wanted to be a disc jockey, but I realised that I had to go and do something that would make me employable in the first place. Okay. So what I did was I trained to be a journalist, because I remember my dad saying to me, nobody's ever going to want to employ a DJ, and how do you get the experience and things like that? So I was doing it at discos, and latterly, I'm afraid, I was spending more time doing discos than studying for my A-levels. So my A-level results were very, very bad, and I didn't even make clearing at Queen's. So I bluffed, my way onto a journalism training course, and for 50 years, I've been bluffing my way ever since. You know, and it's somewhat ironic, but you know, this time 50 years ago, I was a student. My teacher, a lady called Joan Fitzpatrick, only died a few weeks ago at the age of 97. And it's remarkable to think that, you know, in June of 1973, I was unleashed upon the unsuspecting public as a journalist in the Irish News. So I wanted to get that trade, but then equally I wanted to get as quickly as I could into radio, because I didn't want to be a journalist as such, but I did want to be a disc jockey at that time, a DJ.
And is that when you got the job in RT?
Well, no, that was a few years later. Because initially I was riding two horses. Mm-hmm. I was working as a journalist in radio. I was also able to do music programs in radio for Radio Ulster. But then I got the offer of a job on 2FM, which came on stream in 1979. I went down there to Dublin in 1980 for 3 years.
3 years?
Yeah.
So were you, you were living in Dublin and
I was
travelling up and down?
Yes, I was. My residence never changed. I had the residence here. My contractual agreement allowed me to do that as well. But it was a very serious time, because I was in Dublin during the hunger strikes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really did divide opinion down there. And the other thing is, too, that at that particular time, you had Gareth Fitzgerald and Charles Haughey, both of them trying to get a majority so that they could govern the country. And they weren't able to do so, because hunger strikers were getting elected. And as a result, they couldn't take their seats because they were in prison or they were dying and they were being replaced by others as well. So there was it was a real knife edge. And, of course, Northern Ireland at that stage as well was imploding. Because, you know, look at what happened whenever the hunger strikers died one by one by one. And this was a very, very dangerous place at that time. I was still living here. I was also doing some work as a journalist too. So still riding two horses, but realised as well that, you know, being a disc jockey won't last forever, because you can't be forever in your teens or your 20s or your 30s or your 40s or your 50s. And I'm now pushing, I'm 69 now, so I'll be 70 and later on this year.
Yeah, great, great. When did you then make the shift from 2FM to television?
It didn't happen quite like that either, because I was working for 2FM and I was honing my skill there, because previously I had learned how to do an interview with people for radio. Doing what I was doing as a disc jockey in 2FM, I was playing music. And then Radio Ulster was being developed at that stage here, and they wanted me to do a programme in the afternoon which would marry the two. Mm-hmm. So that I would be playing music, but I would also be interviewing people. And so that's what I did. And then from there, I began to do more serious journalism, and then moved on to doing the news on breakfast time on the BBC. And then at the beginning of 1989, I moved from the BBC to UTV. That's where I've been ever since.
Okay. We see you as the person who's presenting the news and interviewing colleagues, journalists, interviewing politicians, and there's a mixture of all sorts in this part of the world, you know. And tell me, who has been the most impressive interviewee that you've had in front of you? You know, that at the end of it, you thought, wow, God.
Well, it depends whether or not the most impressive is necessarily the best interviewee. Okay. Because in truth, the hardest person I ever had to interview was Ian Paisley. And Ian Paisley, whenever you're in the studio, would never make eye contact with you. And I remember asking him this one occasion after the interview. He says, "Dr. Paisley, why would you not look at me?" And he said, "Because I am addressing myself to the great Ulster public and not you, Mr. Clark." You know? And that was genuinely, you know. So he always used an interview, and you could never get one over on him. He will always use an interview to get his message out there as well. And the nearest we have to that now is Jim Allister. Now, I digress slightly. Last night we had a live programme off the back of what Rishi Sunak said and Ursula von der Leyen. And we had Saoirse Eastwood, who is the MLA, Alliance MLA for Lagan Valley, along with Jim Allister, who's the head of the TUV. And Jim Allister was giving it full throttle, you know, why he wouldn't be buying into this deal. And Saoirse Eastwood had said, you know, why she and Alliance would, and Claire Hanna from the SDLP was saying that as well. And I said to Saoirse Eastwood live on the air in front of Jim Allister, I said, Saoirse Eastwood, is there anything that you could do to convince Jim Allister to your way of thinking? At which point she said, Paul, politics is the art of the possible. But when it comes to Jim Allister, it's impossible. Now, this is live on TV, you know, and you know, but you get, you know, and you love things like that. And I mean, Jim was sitting across the studio, and he was having a good old chuckle to himself as well. You know,
he was enjoying it.
He was enjoying the moment. He was.
So, Ian Paisley Senior, the most difficult.
Yes.
And others, just what about someone who say really flummoxed you? You know, in the sense of, you know. What's the point in this?
Well,
you know, kind of thing.
They're not a politician in that case. That one person, and there have been a number of them, but that one person who comes to mind is Gordon Wilson. In the immediate aftermath of the Enniskillen bomb in 1987, when he spoke about forgiveness, when he spoke about reaching out, whenever he said things that made unionists feel very uncomfortable, as well as nationalists and Republicans. And he just nailed it. Because of his simplicity, what he said, how he said it, as a father who was grieving the daughter, whose last words to him in the rubble were, Daddy, I love you very much. And I have been more impressed by people like Gordon Wilson and others who have been bereaved like him than I have by the politicians. And that's not to say that I have any disrespect for politicians. I actually, as much as possible, want to give them a fair wind, because guess what? Democracy is the only show in town. And it's better than what was the alternative. And I think we'll all agree on that one in this room tonight.
So, you know, we've seen you present the news. And most of it, like news, it's only news if it's negative and bad news very often, unfortunately, you know. And it's a delight when there's some good news to present. Is there something that comes to mind about good news that you wanted to get out there on a particular occasion? Was there a particular occasion or a particular person that, you know, Gordon Wilson,
was one, yes. I think that you have to remember that the downside of our job is, by and large, people don't want to hear good news. They tune in to hear bad news. They don't want to know about the aeroplanes that take off and land without incident, but they do want to hear about the two that crash into the Twin Towers in New York. Or the aeroplane, the Air India aeroplane that crashed off the coast of Cork a number of years ago. So, you know, I am glad that my employer, and it's the same with all news programs, because there's light and shade in life for all of us, there are always good news stories out there. There have been a number that I have been particularly proud of. Do any of them come to mind right now? Not just off the top of my head, but what I've been allowed to do in the past has to allow people to tell their stories about the pain that has been visited on them simply because of their father's job or their husband's job. Maybe it was as a police officer or a prison officer or somebody who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I've always been impressed by the people who have said publicly, I don't want any other family to go through what I'm going through right now. And they, the ordinary people, the people like us, essentially, they're the ones who have and continue to impress me most.
I'm just thinking now that we see you in a suit and shirt and tie. Okay?
My
as
uniform?
You are tonight.
Yeah,
but I'm thinking
why are you not wearing your clerical
coat? I know, shocking. But I'm thinking of other occasions, Paul, where you've been on television with your crew neck and your open neck shirt on occasions. And I'm thinking, they were positive occasions or joyful occasions, or they were, you were reporting or you were telling us about something remarkable in people's lives or their family's lives.
Essentially, I suppose I'm old-fashioned about this, but I feel more comfortable wearing a suit, jacket, shirt and shirt and tie, because that's what is expected of you. But yes, there are times whenever you're out there in the field and it's better to dress informally than it is in that. I mean,
what's your preference?
This is what I'm trained to do, so I accept this as being part and parcel
of it.
But there's enough variety in my job to be able to turn around at times and say, look, I think this situation more on serge, shirt and a jumper rather than a shirt and tie.
Okay. Come away from the shirt and tie and the formal in front of the screen. You have a wonderful wife and two sons behind you.
Yep.
You know, Carol and
who I treat
David
very
and Peter.
Badly at times.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
I heard her
very badly at times. Yeah.
And I've had the privilege of meeting them and spending time with them, so I have, in the last couple of years. And I read somewhere that the house that you're living in used to be owned by Rose Neil.
Correct. Indeed. We bought the house off Rose.
You bought the house off Rose, but you didn't know it was Rose's?
No, we didn't. No. Whenever we went to see it.
Yes.
It was only when the owners of the house at that time, they left it to the estate agents. And it was only as my wife and I were having a look around, I said, look who lives here. And that was Rose Neil and her husband, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So, but actually, the same house has another connection with the media.
Okay.
Because previously, it was owned by the BBC in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that was where they would have given the home, they would have given that as the residence for the then controller of the BBC in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And the first controller of the BBC in Northern Ireland I worked under was a gentleman called Dick Francis. Mm-hmm. Now, not to be confused Dick Francis. And Dick Francis' promotion as a controller of the BBC in Northern Ireland came as a direct result of being the director of the live coverage of the first landing on the moon in 1969.
Right.
So there you are. So he was a television director, and for seeing that through, he then became. So I knew him. I was a very small cog in the wheel then. I didn't know where he lived. Uh-huh. It's only all these years later I realised, this house was owned by the BBC.
At home with Carl and David and Peter. What do you like doing? What's your, you know, how do you crash at home? What is it? You know, what do you?
I go to sleep. And I just want to be left alone, absolutely an awful, awful thing to say. My wife, Carol, in truth, who's a real saint, she has allowed me to do what I do with virtual impunity, and I owe her everything. And that being the case, I have not always been as supportive and as good a husband as I should have been, and I put my hand up when I say that. We have two boys, Peter, David. Peter's 34 now. He's very independent, but still living at home. He's done a degree in theology. But the reason why he's still at home at the moment is because he's looking after Mummy, who's not terribly well, and also keeps an eye out on our younger boy, David, who has Down syndrome. So he keeps the house running while I can continue to go to work.
What hobbies do you have?
My work.
Your work.
Sometimes people would say, you know, it's a very sad thing that, you know, your work is your hobby. But actually it is. If I weren't doing it as a job, I would love to be doing it as a hobby anyway. And they pay me to do the job. I think that my job allows me so many interests that I'm able to put together into one place at different times. For example, I love news. I'm a junkie for news. I love history. I love military history. I love language. And I've been able to do an awful lot of programs that have, and I like religion too, in a very practical sense. And so all of that I've been able to put together and to do in a program or programs or stories on the news. And my goodness, and I love reading. And I just think to myself, you know, my goodness, you know, I could never work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. I could never be going into an office and doing a job and then clocking in, clocking out. It's just not me, and it never, never was. So I'm a person of extremes as well, and I have to put my hand up and admit that, because if Carol were here right now, she would say,
you're dead right.
So all I'm saying to you is that, you know, my job provides me with rest and recreation and relaxation as well as the other. As well as the other.
You mentioned languages.
Yes.
You speak Irish.
I do. Conversational.
At what stage did you learn Irish?
Well, I learned Irish at school. Are there any Gaelgors? Will Dina an seo anocht? Ki tá abalta can seo scéalga? Can you? I languages were my best subject. I wasn't really good at maths. I wasn't really good at sciences. Mm-hmm. I liked history. I liked French. And I liked geography, not so much, but certainly politics and economics and things like that I did. Mm-hmm. And languages came naturally. And I think, you know something, I think it goes way back to the fact that whenever I was an altar boy, the mass was in Latin. And the only way you could become an altar boy was if you learnt Latin. Mm-hmm. And I had to do a Latin test. And I remember the name of the teacher, a lady called Maura Fox, and she lived up close to the Sportsman's Inn at Lambeg. Okay. And I can still remember, you know, in tribo ad altari dei, at the emque lactificat juventutum mem, pater noster piques and chelis, and, you know, and so whenever we started doing Latin at school, which we had to do for 5 years, you know, mm-hmm. something clicked. And French was a derivative of Latin. Uh-huh. It was one of the Latino languages. I did Italian, but not Spanish. Mm-hmm. Whenever I wanted to, and I thought Italian would have been a closer relation to to Latin for that reason. But I'm told that Spanish is easier to learn than Italian was. I did a wee bit of conversational German, but only a little bit. Do you know why? They wouldn't teach us German at St. Mary's, because in those days I discovered years later that they wouldn't teach German because German, they viewed German as being the language of the Reformation, because Martin Luther was a German priest, and his theses at Wittenberg. So, and this was told to me by a teacher who taught Irish years later, who said to me he was qualified to teach German and Irish, but the brothers would only allow him to teach Irish.
Holidays. Where do you go for holiday? Where is your family? Where do you go to be with family, you know, and those, you know, what are those special times, you know, when you do take off the suit and the shirt and tie?
Donegal. I love Fermanagh. Fermanagh, Donegal are two very, very special places to me. I love Donegal because I grew up always being able to go there. And there's a little place that we love, a little village called Kilcar, which is near Slieve League. And it's on the edge of a Gaeltacht area.
And the rusty mackerel.
And the rusty mackerel, absolutely, yes.
Absolutely.
No visit to Teelin is complete without... And one visit to the rusty mackerel is never enough.
That's right. Never enough, you know. Absolutely, yeah. My heart is in Donegal.
Oh, well, ta mochri on shit. Ta mochri sat there, Conal. My heart is there. My heart is in Donegal.
Do you cook?
No.
That's it.
I am very bad. I am a typical unreconstructed bachelor boy. I can wash these days, and you know, I find ironing quite therapeutic. Uh-huh. Now, I'm not suggesting that you bring all your ironing to me now, but I do. It's probably something to do with, you know, ironing out the creases.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, there's something therapeutic about that.
Okay. Yeah. Are you any good at DIY?
No.
No. Okay.
I am awful.
What's your favourite dish to eat?
Oh, Chinese food, because it's dead easy. And you know, and you just go along and you order it, and that's it. And it
comes.
I'm not really setting a very good example here, am I?
Okay.
I am so sorry. I really am. But
Are you picky about food?
No, I'm not actually. And my wife would say to me that I've got lead guts. That, you know, nothing ever seems to repeat on me, good or bad, in that sense.
You are blessed.
You're blessed. But equally, I have to say this to you. My work has occasionally taken me into the developing world. And I hope we have a wee bit of an opportunity to talk about that, because I've seen it firsthand, the difference that Irish missionaries have made in so many different parts of the world. And whenever you go out there and you're living among them, you've got to be very careful about what you eat and how you eat. So I remember... always being told, you know, don't eat salads, don't eat anything that hasn't been cooked, that kind of thing. And I've always lived by a very, very boring, bland diet. So essentially, there's boiled rice, and maybe there are a few beans and lentils and things like that. Okay, that's essentially it. That's how I would live while I'm out there. But there have been occasions whenever you're invited into somebody's home, and you cannot not accept. And I discovered this prayer from a missionary she was a Presbyterian missionary, she was from Whitehead. And she said to me, Paul, she said, pray the prayer that I pray. And I said, what's that? And she said, dear Lord, I'll put it down. You keep it down.
There you go.
And you know, the number of times, the number of times internally I have, I said that, you know, said that prayer.
And it worked.
And it worked. It works. Dear Lord, I put it down. You keep it down.
Do you like going out for meals or restaurants?
I don't get that much of an opportunity these days, Peter. Because my working day is my working night, if you know what I mean. Like here I am tonight. Yeah. But I never wanted to work days. I'm more of a night person than I am now. Okay. Nothing would please me more than to be able to go out more than I do. Okay. 4 nights a week are spent working, so there's a Friday, a Saturday, and a Sunday. Carol is not able to get out very much at the moment. Okay. So essentially what we do is we tend to eat in rather than out. Yeah. But nothing pleases me more than to be able to go out and not have to worry about doing the dishes.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. If it could be organised for you to have a night out. Mm-hmm. In a nice restaurant.
Yes.
And there's some beautiful ones here in Belfast. We're blessed.
We are.
Who would be the one person you'd love to be at the table with you?
My wife.
After your wife.
But you see, the mere fact that I would consider anybody else other than my wife would get me into big trouble too.
You know, with your wife there. And David and Peter as well.
And David and Peter. Who, I mean, boy.
Is there anyone else? You know, they think. You know, I'm thinking of a table. Meal is just not eating food, or eating the Chinese or the blunt. It's to do with conversation, to do with relationships, it's to do with the crack, it's to do with, you know, getting to know each other or bouncing off each other, you know, somebody telling the story around the table.
Do you know something? Let me tell you this. Now, no one is more surprised to be saying this than me right now. Okay. So this is a long way of telling you who I would like already. For the first time in my life, I'm listening to my mother. My mother is now 92. My mother's journey in life was very, very different from mine, but she gave everything for all of us in the family. And for the first time in my life, I'm sitting and I'm listening to her and I'm hearing things that she says. And I'm saying, Mum, I never knew that. And she will go on about it then, you know. And I'm so building up a new picture of my mum, more as a friend and than somebody who is somebody way up there. Uh-huh. So next to Carol, it would have to be my mum, actually. Uh-huh. It would genuinely have to be my mum, because I'm learning things about mum now that I never really gave much thought to. And I look at her generation. I mean, she was born in County Louth in the countryside. They lived on the land of the local landlord. Her father worked for the farm, right? They didn't have electricity. She was born in 1931. They had tilly lamps, right? They didn't have running water. She would have to go to the nearest pump. And if it was the winter time, you would light straw around it to heat it up so as to defrost it. Yeah. And you think of how we live our lives today, you know? And I just, you know, that's not that long ago. This is my mother we're talking about here. And I love history. I love social history as well. I like that part of our history. And so I can just sit and listen to her and take it in.
And you're taking in now as an adult and, as you say, as a friend rather than mother and son.
Yes, I am. And I'm wondering to myself, why did I not do this before now? And then the other thing I say to myself is, because I tell some of my colleagues at work and they turn around and say, aren't you lucky that you can do that? Because their mother may have died whenever she was in her 60s. And if my mum had died 30 years ago, you know, would I have had the time or the interest to take and listen to her now, as I am now? Probably not.
Yeah. Your mum came to Belfast to nurse?
She did. That's right. Yes, she came.
And that's where she met your dad?
Indeed.
God rest him, Thompson.
An Ulster Protestant. Yes.
That's right. Yeah.
I have to tell you a great story about that. Uh-huh. No, but yes, mum nursed with her sister. It was not that long after the war. She was still a teenager, and there were a number of buildings around Belfast where there were injured soldiers and airmen and sailors from the Second World War. So she would have been working with them, essentially, helping them recover and recuperate that. So there was this place, which is not there anymore, but it's where Forest Side is, thereabouts. And it wasn't very far from where my father lived. And so it was sort of his playground area. Uh-huh. And that's where he met Mum, and the rest is history. But here was the thing. In the early 1950s, Northern Ireland was a very different place. And my father, Ulster Presbyterian, mother, Irish Catholic, they fell in love and they wanted to get married. And my mother said to my dad, I'm not going to make you change. And my father said, because he was largely nominal in terms of his faith, he says, well, I will change. I will become a Catholic. And they were married in October of 1952. Many, many years later, they renewed their vows again. And they were married up at Holy Cross, Ardoyne. Father Miles Kavanagh is a friend of mine. He's one of the retired priests up there. He said the Mass for them. And he went back into the archive to find out who married my mother and father. And my father had been instructed in the faith by a priest who was unable to take the marriage. So he passed it on to another priest up there called Father Honorius Kelly. And Father Honorius Kelly married my mother and father. Now, there were only four people there, mum and dad and two witnesses. And it was in a wee side chapel at Holy Cross, Ardoyne. But Miles Kavanagh said to me, he says, Paul, Father Honorius Kelly, he had a brother who was the cartoonist for the Irish Times in Dublin. And that brother had a son who became a very well-known comedian. And his name was Frank Kelly. And his best-known alter ego was Father Jack Hackett in Father Ted.
Yes.
And he modelled his character on Father Honorius Kelly, who was very fond of the drink. So whenever I told this to my dad, the first thing he said was, maybe I'm not married after all. So there you go. That was Father Honorius Kelly. Not an easy name to forget.
Not at all. Absolutely. Yeah. Paul, your dad sadly died just 3 years ago.
Yes, indeed, so 3 years ago next month.
And it was it was the first week of our first lockdown in March, 25th of March, 2020. Yeah. And my own brother, Morris, God rest him, he died 2 days before that, the 23rd, in Scotland, unexpectedly. Yeah. And that time of the lockdown, of course, there was, six of us at the funeral, whatever. Yes. We had a lovely wee service here in the church for Dad, and then we went to Roselawn.
Can I say this, Peter, if I'm allowed to? There is so much grief surrounding death. Death is, you can look at it in a detached way and say death is part of life, as life is part of death. But when it's your dad, it's different. And, you know, if it had been a normal Mass, I mean, Mum and Dad always wanted Dad to be rest overnight in the church, to have a Mass. We couldn't do that. We could not do that. He had to remain at Elwood's, the other side of Dunmurry, came down. We couldn't even have a full Mass, as you will remember that time as well. And the fact that there were only a small number of us there, I think it made it easier for us as a family to take it in. Because all too often, if there were a lot of people around, I think that you're infected with their grief as well. Mm-hmm. And as an individual, you're trying to deal with the grief and understand as best you can. So actually, at one level, I'm very thankful that COVID did what it did to us, because we have been able to revisit that. And Dad was cremated. We couldn't even go into the chapel at Roselawn. And I remember you must have been doing this with other funerals as well, because I remember you had to, the final committal was outside, and the guys were in fatigues, and they had a low loader, and the coffin was put with as much dignity as we could onto that low loader, and it was taken in.
And the doors were closed.
And that was it. Yeah. And it was awful. But you see, there's another part of me which says, and I genuinely, genuinely believe this, death is not the end. And the priest is paid to say that in one way. But those of us of faith really ought to believe it, because my faith, brought up in the Catholic Church, my faith these days, I worship in the Reformed tradition, that may be another story for a little bit later in the conversation. But I take such comfort from what C.S. Lewis said when he wrote, we are not a body with a soul. We are a soul with a body. The body will grow old, get sick, it'll die, and will waste away. But the soul is eternal. The soul will go on and on and on forever. And I believe that. And I believe my dad's in heaven. He had made his peace with God many, many years before. One of the immense privileges of my life was to be with Mum and Dad both when you anointed them. They wanted that, you know, and it was something that they wanted, and it was a tremendous privilege for me to be there, to be part of it. Yeah. I mean, as they call it now, it's not so much anointing. It's a sacrament of the sick. That's right, yes. Right. You know, it's not extra. Right. They don't call it extra unction anymore, do they, in that sense?
No,
you know, because that's next stop.
Absolutely.
It is the grave, you know. Yeah. So that's all I'm saying to you. And I also have to say as well, at the risk of embarrassing Father Peter, you have been an absolute rock to us as a family. Really have. And, you know, I've discovered that, you know, clergy, Catholic and Protestant, do that so well. They do it very, very well indeed. And I think that there is a certainty that you have, that you know death is not the end either, that it's not the final, the finality. And that has helped us. And I'm certain that, you know, as I look around this room here, we could all say that. We have our doubts. We will have, you know, questions that we cannot answer. But too much has happened to me in my life for me not to believe in God, not to believe in the primacy of God in all things. And I look forward to being able to have a conversation like this with you again in heaven. And I mean that. But not just yet.
No, not yet. No. We'll hold that.
Not yet.
Absolutely. Thank you very much indeed, Paul. I'm conscious that those last days that your dad lived were in the hospice.
Yes, they were. Where I'm the president.
A place that is very dear to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, and we've all been privileged to share that over the years, you know, and your work for the hospice and how you promote that. A wonderful place, a place of grace, a place of blessing, a place of care and compassion, gentleness. Mm-hmm. And I remember your dad being so much comfortable in that place.
And not only that, but I'm the president of the hospice now. I'm not hands-on in any sense, but they use my profile to get the message out there. But I would be in and out anyway, and indeed there as a son to my father. But the chaplains I would be very close to anyway. And I got a lovely note from the chaplaincy after my father died, and it was, towards the end of his life, Paul, your father ministered to us. Such was the certainty of God, the love of God, and all of that. And so they were taking comfort from my father's journey out of this world and into the next.
And that's the privilege that I as a minister and others who minister to the sick and the dying continually would express. I go into a situation, I don't know what I'm going to be faced with, I don't know what I can say or what I can do, but I come out, I think, I have received much. I've received more than what I went into to give.
And do you know why that is? Because you go in as an empty vessel and you can be filled. If we all go in with too much in our vessels, God can't fill it. There's too much of us. So I have discovered, as you have,
empty ourselves.
And you've just articulated that. You have to empty yourself. And you will find that God will fill that in the most surprising and enlightening of ways.
Lovely. You also, UNICEF.
Yes.
Has been another area of your life.
It has. I feel very strongly about the developing world. So I'm a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador for Northern Ireland, and I've been overseas with them a few times. You and I were speaking earlier about a Church of Ireland clergyman who you knew in your previous parish, Cecil Wilson, who was involved with the Church of Ireland charity called CMS, Church Mission Society. And I had visited many different parts of the world with him. And I, one of the things that really angers me at times here is whenever people would turn round and they're being interviewed after a night in A&E, for example, in a hospital, and they'll come out with this line, it's worse than the third world. And I'm thinking to myself, you have absolutely no idea what you are talking about. And I say this to my colleagues, I said, that needs to be challenged. Because I can assure you that the worst of the worst here is absolutely nothing like it is in the developing world. I've been in that situation with UNICEF, with Médecins Sans Frontières, with TROCRA, with CMS. And I find myself in situations where children are sitting in their own feces, and that's not deliberate, but they just don't have the people. They don't have nappies, and they just got to wait until somebody comes along and lifts the baby and hopefully lifts the feces as well. And I'm sorry, you know, I see that, and I've been privileged to see it and to come back and to try and tell stories about that in different programs. And one story that lives with me, and it's the one that I heard through Cecil, because in Africa, and this was in Sudan, the Anglican Church, a big thing in the Anglican Church is confirmation. And there was one occasion whenever they were in the bush in this church, and the bishop, he realized that there weren't as many people in the church for confirmation as he had expected. And he was asking the clergy, why is this? And he said, because they have no clothes to wear. And I look at the choices that we have made tonight about the clothes that we would wear. They have no clothes to wear. And that bishop, who's dead, but whom I met on a number of occasions, Bishop Semi Solomona, he asked that word would be sent out into the bush, that they would come to church after dark, and he would confirm them then. We have no idea what we are living in at the moment. We will complain. We're paying high prices. We're getting our £600, which we need. But I can assure you, you know, we're in heaven compared to those people. We really are. And you know something? They're not the third world. They're our world. They are the same world as us. And we have a responsibility to them as we have to ourselves. Who is my neighbour? They are our neighbours. You are my neighbours, but they are our neighbours too. And the God that I love and worship is colourblind. He doesn't see black, white. He doesn't see yellow. He just sees people. And you know, he's very fond of people because he made a lot of us, didn't he? You know, we really did. Absolutely. So my God is unashamedly colourblind.
Yeah. I'm very conscious that, you know, something you said there that about the third world, we have a one world group in our parish. And that has always struck me, the label that's called. It's one world. It's not a third world group.
Correct.
It's a one world group, you know. Mm-hmm. And because that speaks of there's no barriers. No. There's no us and them. There's no him and her. There's no, you know, those who have and those who haven't. Because when we face those who haven't particular things, we realise we are the ones who haven't.
Yes.
We are the poor.
Yes. 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 I remember there's another charity that I've been involved with called Tear Fund, which was started by an Anglican clergyman in the 1960s, George Hoffman, who's sadly died a number of years ago. But George Hoffman was confronted whenever he was out in a country, I can't remember which one it was, and he was having a conversation with the local clergy. And he said, in your country, they said to George, meaning these islands, our home, the UK, in your country, you have God and things. Here, we just have God. And the message there was that the things that we have in life can often act as a barrier between God and us. They get in the way of what God really wants us to do. And I'm as guilty of that as anybody else. I live a comfortable existence. But, you know, I hope and have to be a good steward of all that God has given me.
I want to ask you, just complete change in one sense, with your growing up and music and DJ. Give me a piece of music that you take from that past.
Okay, well, I could have taken, you know, you're being very, very cheeky. Only give me one choice here, but no.
Well,
right, okay. This is a piece of music from the middle 1960s. It's the Birds, Turn, Turn, Turn. The message in that is eternal because it's from Ecclesiastes. There's a season for everything. We said goodbye a few weeks ago to David Crosby, who played on that. And he lived until he was 81. He abused his body, something terrible. So nobody is more surprised than those of us who loved him and his music that he lived until he was the age of 81. Continued smoking until the very, very end. But he was a very, very gifted guitarist, very gifted singer. Okay. And I think Pete Seeger was involved in the writing of this particular song.
Can we listen to it?
As well. Yeah.
Let's listen.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Lovely. Lovely
takes,
to hear that.
Takes me back to the 60s.
That brings
and,
back
and I'm not the only one in this room either, by the way. Am I?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Other music, of course, speaks in a different way to your faith is very often, as we know within our parishes, we express it through music and through song, through hymns. And the words speak very powerfully to us, you know. That happens for you too, Paul.
It does. It does. Yeah. My faith journey took me out of the church of my birth. Mm-hmm. But I don't want you to take that the wrong way. I was born and brought up Catholic. And I think that in my 20s, particularly when I was living and working in Dublin, I was looking out for myself. And being very, very selfish. And I probably was a very nominal Catholic. Would I have taken the sacraments? No. Would I have gone to Mass regularly? No. And I suppose in one sense that made me a normal Catholic. I don't know. But I always felt that God was talking to me. And I found myself going to other places of worship to see what God was trying to say to me. So I find myself going to churches like the Methodist Church of Ireland, Salvation Army, I have to say as well, Baptist, other non-denominational types of church, which were just open to expressing the love of God and the challenge that God has for each of us. And I found in that way, now, I don't want this to come across the wrong way, but they say confession is good for the soul. So this is it. Okay, I find at times that Catholic dogma was getting in the way between me and God, or God and me. And I don't know if that was my fault or my view of the world, but at that stage, I believed that if you were baptized and if you were confirmed and if you kept all the rules, you were safe, you were in. It was like being a member of a club, and all you had to do was keep the rules and live a good life, and away you go to heaven at the end of it all. And I was uncomfortable with that because I almost felt that I, as an individual, was being absolved of having to take any responsibility. Now, I know I was wrong because I have got great fellowship with priests, you know, Father Martin McGill and Paul Simons and some people like that, who say, no, you've got it all wrong. And I'm, you know, they are right. We do. So my journey took me out of the Catholic Church, but do not ever ask me to deny my Catholicism or deny the part that Catholicism plays in my life, that part that I bring with me on the journey in all of my experiences. So I have felt very strongly that I am a Christian, yes, and I'm very uncomfortable with denominational terms, even though I was born into and brought up as a Catholic. I worship now in a Presbyterian church, Fitzroy, in South Belfast, and I'm uncomfortable with the term Presbyterian. Indeed, there would be many people who would view the way we worship and the kind of fellowship that we have with so many different people, not least our friends at Clonard, because we've got the Clonard Fitzroy Fellowship. They would not believe we were Presbyterian at all. You know, we're Presbyterian in name only. Yes. But I don't get hung up on that. Yes. But what I do try and live by is the fact that, you know, God calls all of us to do a certain thing, to be his hands and his feet where we are. And my life was not always like that. Whenever I went into broadcasting, into journalism, I was extremely selfish. It was all about me. God was secondary. And I've discovered on the journey, and particularly now at this stage in my career, that my life and my job was never about me. It was always about God. And I have been preserved to do the job that I do for a reason, which is bigger than me. And I don't even know the answer, in truth. But the fact is that, you know, for 50 years, I've been working through the troubles from almost the beginning to where we are now. And I don't feel that it's over yet. But I hope that whenever it does end, this chapter closes, shall we say, that I will see it coming, that I will accept it with grace, and that I will say to God, what next? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What next?
Labels. So often we like to label someone, you know, we pigeonhole them. And yet in your professional life, you're being presented with people who have labels.
Yes.
Because their name goes along the bottom and who they are and what political party or who they represent, mm-hmm. who they're speaking for, come up all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's not just MLA, it's Sinn Féin, it's Ulster Union, it's TUV.
Yeah.
You know, why can it not just be MLA?
Because, you know, because we live in a democracy, yeah. and because people vote for people, whether they are an individual mm-hmm. or a party, and mm-hmm. it's important mm-hmm. that you exercise the franchise that you have been given. Mm-hmm. People paid very, very dearly for it. So I have no issue whatsoever mm-hmm. in seeing the likes uh-huh. of Sinn Féin DUP or TUV or whatever coming up, because that tells me that we are living in a democratic society. These people have a mandate and they have been voted for as well. And ever since I got the vote at age 18, I have never missed an election in my life. There was one election happening up here and I was living in Dublin at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was so important for me to vote that I came up from Dublin, I voted in Lisburn where I had my address, and then went back down again to Dublin. It was that important.
That responsibility.
Yeah, it was.
That each of us have a part to play, and the part, the small part that I might play is still vitally important.
You see, that small part is mm-hmm. open to all of us. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think that we should ever underestimate or undervalue mm-hmm. that small part mm-hmm. that we have to play, whatever that is and wherever that is. And often in terms of the world, you know, we're done down, or we do ourselves down because, you know, we're not as famous as somebody else. We don't have as much money as somebody else, you know. Please, you know, we've got to stop thinking like that. Uh-huh. You've got to look at the people who are around you who seem to have it all, and you ask yourself, how happy are they? And I know that you don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but let me tell you, whenever I was a disc jockey in Dublin and I was in my middle 20s and I was single, I was having an absolute ball. I was really living it up. I was enjoying it. I was enjoying the fame. I was enjoying the adulation. I was enjoying the money. It came to an end after 3 years. You see, if it hadn't, I'm not sure I'd be alive right now. Because so many of the people that I worked with then have died. They drank too much. They took drugs. I know that I was spared that by coming back up here, by meeting Carol, by marrying Carol. Because I have the capacity to self-destruct at that level. Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. And I've been saved and spared for that reason. And I still don't know. But Carol has been used mightily by God. Uh-huh. And I still get it wrong, by the way.
Yes.
I do.
Okay.
I do. Uh-huh. I do. Yeah. And the men in this room will understand me.
Good. You have other relationships, Paul. These particular people these on-screen wives that you have.
My wife is a very understanding lady, yes.
Another Clark,
that's right, but no relation. But here's the thing.
Yes.
Whenever, you see, before she married, she was Sarah Dobson, and she married a guy called Clark, and he's related to the Eastwoods. I don't know, now not Mr. Eastwood, but the Eastwoods, the car people in this part of the world. Her husband is part of that family, that extended family. But I remember when Sarah Clark started presenting the news as Sarah Clark, you know, people were saying, is she any relation of yours? Is that your wife? Is she your daughter? And I would say, no, I'm her sugar daddy. But we all genuinely, as a team, we all get on very well because we're paid to make it work, yeah. Whatever uh-huh. that is.
Sure.
And again, you know, there is one night a week I would normally be doing with Sarah. Three nights a week I would be doing with Rose and then the likes of Mark. Mm-hmm. They never put two male presenters together. They usually like to have a balance, so it'll be male female. Yeah. But I mean, we all work in a very small environment. We all get on very well together. Yeah. Mark is the late reporter tonight, so I presume he'll be hoping that there's not too much happening out there.
Sure, absolutely. I do a little bit of cycling every so often. I haven't been on the bike for a while, but very often I would cycle across to Mayor Peter's track and go down to join the towpath. Mm-hmm. I would go right, turn right, head for Lisburn, or turn left, head for Stranmillis, and on into Belfast. And a number of times I've gone into Belfast and I go right across and down the Omaru embankment, right across to down to the waterfront and around there, and then further out. This particular occasion, I'm coming back from a trip that I'd gone out to Jordanstown. So it's quite a long cycle, but I'm coming back and I'm coming through past Duncrew and into past your new studio offices.
Oh, yes, City Keys.
And there's a new building right beside it. It's just finished recently.
It is, City Keys 3.
But they were building it at the time, and the hoarding was right round it. And the cycle path and the footpath become one. There was a gate just there. And I'm cycling, and through the gate walks Rose. She's obviously heading to the office, heading to work. But as myself and Rose, I've got my shades on, my helmet on, and all the gear on, high-vis jacket and all.
You were that stalker, were you?
Yeah, I was that stalker. But as we were just about to pass, and I would, you know, maybe say, hello, Rose. Yeah. In the hoarding, there was an open gate, pedestrian gate. And out runs this labourer in high-vis jacket and hard helmet right in front of me. And I had to suddenly stop. And Rose, he just missed her. He ran right through us, heading somewhere. Maybe to go and get a sandwich or something, whatever, you know. But it was a moment, and I thought, you know, the two of us could have been in a heap outside there on the footpath, you know. But
how good are you at presenting?
So none of us fell and whatever, and she went on, and I went on, you know. But that was the closest I got to an encounter with Rose, you know.
You lucky boy.
So you're closer than this.
I have the
generally.
I have to live with that
absolutely.
Joy 3-4 days
right.
a week.
So,
I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Music, hymns, religious music.
Uh-huh. I mean, I remember, whenever I was growing up, you know, I remember the likes of Tanta Mergo and O Sacrament, Most Holy, O Sacrament Divine, things like that. And, but the piece of, are we coming to the piece of music now? Yes, yeah. I love a great deal of contemporary music, and I realize as well that an awful lot of what were the traditional Catholic hymns, you now hear more untraditional Catholic hymns being sung at mass, and I like that because I think they all have a story to tell. This piece of music has, for the last number of years, been voted the most popular hymn on Songs of Praise. It's called In Christ Alone. And it is written by a guy from Lisburn, Keith Getting. And Stuart Townend, he wrote it together. Keith Getty did the music for it. Stuart Townend did the words. And Keith's wife, Kristen, who's from Glengormley, She would sing as well. Now, they are an accomplished pair because only a few weeks ago, their most recent album was shortlisted for one of the categories of the Grammys in America. Mm-hmm. But they didn't make it. I think they were beaten. I can't remember the name of the person who did win it. But they were up there with the big boys and the big girls, if you know what I mean. Uh-huh. And this hymn, it talks to me about faith. It also talks to me about the things that are going on in this world that can trip us up. You know, there's a line in it in the last verse, no power of hell, no scheme of man can ever take us from his hand. And I really, really believe that. And there have been twists and turns that I may not even have been aware of. Mm-hmm. And I have been protected. Mm-hmm. So this is called In Christ Alone. I want it played at my funeral, but not yet. It just, it speaks loudly to me. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And it's a very simple tune and a very simple hymn. Uh-huh. And this is it.
Okay. Thank you.
In Christ alone, my hope is found. He is my life, my strength, my song. This cornerstone, this solid ground, firm through the fiercest drowning storm. What heights of love, what depths of peace, when fears are still, when striving cease. My comforter, my all in all, here in the love of Christ I stand. In Christ alone, who took on flesh, fullness of God in heaven.
Fading it out now. We're just coming up to that verse. Scheme of man,
isn't it,
no power of
hell. Isn't it powerful the way it actually increases in volume again? Isn't it?
The power of the priest.
Okay.
This is it coming up now. No power of hell, no scheme of man.
Love, no need for this, to be cursed.
Thank you for that, Peter. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. I hope that that spoke to you as it does to me every time I hear it. Mm-hmm. It's what our faith's about. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very comfortable talking about mm-hmm. faith matters, and I never thought I would be mm-hmm. as comfortable as I am, mm-hmm. quite frankly, yeah. because often, you know, it's dragged into a conversation. It only comes up whenever, you know, you're with the priest or, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. somebody is in trouble or whatever. Yeah. And yeah. I just, in my journey, I've been immensely privileged to have been able to talk. Like it doesn't faze on me, and I hope I'm not ramming it down your throats either tonight. Seriously about that, because
no, you've always been, you've come across to me as very comfortable in talking about
your
faith.
Yes, I am. Great.
And the other thing, in you know, over a recent conversation, you said that your faith is it has to be a very practical faith.
It's not.
And you mentioned and when I asked you about scripture, particular scripture, you mentioned St. James' letter.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. and that's why I've pulled up that quotation from the second chapter of James.
James,
there.
Yes,
you
know, indeed.
But someone will say, "Your faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by what I do." Yeah.
And that's you know, often we will say the right things; they come off our tongue, but actually, it's what we do. It's how we live our lives. That is that practical Christianity that I aspire to. And I feel that very, very strongly. James articulates it so well. I love the book of Proverbs, wisdom, Solomon's words. They speak very, very loudly to me, very loudly.
Yeah, yeah. Paul, we've come to the end, really, of our wonderful evening. It's been an absolute delight and a privilege.
Thank you.
To sit here with you. And
can I ask you a question?
Okay. Yes.
No. I'm serious. I don't want to overstay my welcome either here. Okay. Yeah. I was at a funeral earlier today of a colleague of mine, a fellow journalist, called Henry MacDonald. He was latterly the correspondent, the Ireland correspondent for The Guardian and for The Observer. He was 57. He died of cancer. He came from the markets. He would have been born into and brought up in the Catholic Church. I expected somehow that he would be buried from St. Malachy's, which would have been the home parish. But it wasn't. It was a humanist funeral at the Oh Yeah Music Centre in the city centre. And he was into punk music, and music is wonderful. It speaks to us at so many different levels. And so it was a musical farewell. But it struck me, because his case isn't isolated. I have come across so many people who were born and brought up Catholic, who lost their religion, who lost their faith, who became very anti-church, anti-faith, anti-Christian. And I'm just wondering, why did that happen? Because they would have been brought up. Was it the way the church spoke to them? Was it the way priests spoke to them? My view, and the humanist celebrant allowed those of us of faith to have a moment of reflection and prayer. I felt, because I know within myself death is not the end, that it was a two-dimensional parting rather than the third dimension that I know is there for all of us. But don't ask me to prove it. And I'm just wondering, you know, why do so many people lose their faith when they're born into a family of faith? Like, you know, I grew up, we prayed the rosary. And, you know, I pray with my father and with my mother as well. And why do so many people do that? Why? What goes wrong? What happens?
I think, you know, as parents and as grandparents, you know, that you're very much aware of within own families and within my own family too, there's that drift away, and there can be that big drift away at teenage years. And I've also seen the recapture of faith and the practice of it too, when marriage comes along and the first child is born, and that's a wonderful moment and wonderful gifted moment, and being aware of that journey that so many people make, I as a priest find myself that I need to try and be the best in those situations when I'm celebrating a marriage or celebrating a baptism, that And when there's a death in the family, I need to bring that care and compassion and not the rules and regulations and the dogma to the situation, you know. But bring Christ to it, that situation. What would Christ say going into this house where there's pain and loss and hurt? What would Christ say to this young couple who are making a decision for better, for worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and health all the days of our life? What would Jesus say to this couple who, you know, we want our child done? Not too sure what that means, you know, but somehow they want to, it's something that they've picked up from their grandparents, and they want something that is treasured by another generation, but somehow it's special and important. So how can we be the best for it? So I find myself challenged in that, Paul.
And if you were to, yeah. I mean, you're not going to be having a conversation now with Henry MacDonald, but I mean, if you were having a conversation with somebody who had fallen away from their faith, who just said, look, you know, I don't believe this stuff, you know, three in one and all of that. I'm just wondering, what do you say? Because as far as Jesus is concerned, nobody is beyond redemption. But we're not God. You know, and I'm just wondering, you know, do you find yourself in a situation like that where you're talking to people who say, I'm an atheist, Father. You know, spare me the sermon.
Sure. Yeah. And I try to spare them the sermon and say, well, what is important, boys around, is goodness and love. And the people who are important in your life, trying to be the best for them. Now, whether you give that a label of, you know, Christianity or any other faith, you know, it's being the best, drawing out the best, allowing people to live their lives to their full potential, and rather than put a label on it. That's what God sees. God doesn't put a label on us, you know. And then that, and what God sees in us is a perfect human being. And he's loving us now, and if you've heard me say so, he's loving us in our next breath. So he is. I can take my next breath because he's loving me unconditionally.
I get that.
Yeah.
I get that.
And we're called, you know, called to be saints. But let's remember that saints are sinners. First, sinners who never stop trying. They get up and have another go. And that's, you know, so you can't put a label on that. You can't put the name of an institution on that, I believe. But I believe it's a shared experience of relationship.
Maybe we should be asking more questions of you. Not in an accusing way, but I think that we need to hear people like you talking more like that. Because you're speaking like us. You know what I mean? And that's so necessary for all of us.
Yeah, I think it's recognizing that we're all on a journey, and each one is on a different part of that journey, and we have to respect that journey. And tonight, it's been a wonderful journey, Paul, to have you here in St. Anne's, and thank you for coming home for this moment.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Thank you for having me. A wonderful privilege to share with you. We know that next Tuesday, we have.
Now, wait till I tell you about Jerry Kelly.
I'll tell you. So, we've another guest. Again, a presenter, an interviewer, with a wonderful story to tell. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward very much to Jerry. But, Paul, I want to thank you very much indeed. I want you to convey to your beloved mother, Ida, our love and our prayer, and I'm looking forward to seeing her.
Well,
now she gets back into her own home.
She will be doing it
Absolutely looking forward to it. And please give our best wishes to Philip and Susan and Maureen as well,
indeed.
And Carl and David and Peter.
Thank you.
It's a delight.
And can I say thank you to
thank
all
you
of you
much,
because I still feel very much a part of this parish, the extended family that is St. Anne's, which takes me right back to the age of four, whenever we moved out to Seymour Hill. And it's hard to believe it, you know, I am still here at this age, but you know, I'm sitting around here and I'm looking at you people as well. And you know, we are the hands and the feet of God. We are His presence, whether it's in this parish or the next parish or the local Church of Ireland church or wherever that is. And I hope that all of us can, through these very depressing times, hold fast to our faith, hold on to God, because I have discovered He is the only way. He is the only way.
Paul, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, everyone. We look forward to seeing you next Tuesday. Same time, same place. Yeah.
Are you not coming to Mass on Sunday? Or yeah, Saturday night?
Yes, they're all going to be there.
It's like there used to be a big event. I think it was the height of Drumcree, right? Okay, and they would have, I know. The Orange were marching to the church at the beginning of July, and at the end of the service, the priest would say, or not the priest, the minister would turn around and say, "Well, brethren, let me wish you a happy Christmas, because the next time I'll see you in this church will be next July."
Thank you very much.
All right.